And I believe I have heard our next presenter show up. Mr. Ron Brooks, are you here?
He is here.
Awesome.
I'm having a little issue here with give me 1 second. Okay, I'm going to turn on my video here. All right, so I am, just for those of you who cannot see me, and those of you who can, my apologies. I am wearing a plaid shirt and a cowboy hat, which I guess I'm indoors. So I'm gonna take the hat off because it's impolite. But we are gonna talk about target practice. And the name of this presentation is Target Practice, determining which transit issues are local, which are federal, and how to hit where you're aiming, which is pretty important. So I'm going to flip over the presentation and then mute my speech. PowerPoint slide shows easy. There we go. Shut that up. All right. So now I only have to turn it on if I get lost. So before I jump in, let me just say this presentation was created for this conference. So hopefully you'll find it useful. And we're gonna have lots of time as we go through for questions. And so is it okay if stop at certain points and invite questions, or would you rather I go straight to the end?
I was gonna say
whatever you'd like.
Yeah, okay. You have Andrea here. So you just tell Andrea what you would like for her to do. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. And I'll try to describe as we go. There's lots of pictures in here. So we will we'll have a little bit of fun, and here we go. So on this slide here, I have two hats, and I wear two hats. I have a black hat that says transit industry, 29 years. and I have a white hat, which is life experience as a blind, low vision person. And it's my whole life since I was born. So I have, you know, I grew up as a person with low vision, lost my eyesight as a teenager, and spent my time. I actually came to graduate school in San Francisco in 1990. I was actually an ACB scholarship recipient in 1990, and I've been involved in ACB ever since. So you know, it's a long time in the ACB. Spent a number of years in the CCB and chapters up in the Bay Area. And yeah, really, you guys are close to my heart. And I'm really excited to be here talking to you all about something that is my passion. So that black hat, the transit industry hat, I put that on in 1993. I began my transit career in the San Francisco Bay Area at BART, working on accessible transit services. There, what I was doing at BART initially was working on helping improve key station accessibility, and also working on accessibility projects at new BART stations. They're not new anymore. If you're in the Bay Area and you're familiar with the Daly City Station and the SFO Extension, and yeah, these are old stations now, but when I was there, those weren't even holes in the ground, and we were talking about how to make them accessible. I then got into paratransit back in the days before there was an East Bay paratransit. I was involved in working with BART to try to figure out how to comply with ADA. These were new requirements back then. Since then, I'm on the slide, I say I've moseyed all over the country dealing with accessible transit and paratransit. Spent some time in Florida, some time in New Mexico, back in California, and then up in Illinois. Our present homestead is in just over the border in Phoenix. And I got to tell you, Arizonans really do believe that California is another country. And I suspect that y'all feel the same way about us. So, and we've been here for about 15 years. But my work takes me all over the country. I have a consultancy called Accessible Avenue, where we are really working with the industry to try to improve accessibility and mobility for all disabled people, including people who are blind or visually impaired. And as of Monday, I'm going to start a new second thing, which is working with an on-demand paratransit company called Userve, which has a very small footprint in California right now, but it's a growing company that's doing on-demand paratransit, which is something that I believe that the time has come to start pushing into the industry. So we can talk more about that if, you know, later, if y'all wish. So on this slide, it's called a rugged landscape. And I've got a picture here of a rough high desert landscape. There's boulders and scrub brush and a blue sky with white fluffy clouds. This looks like just about anywhere in the desert Southwest. And transit is a rough landscape. It's very confusing. It's very rugged. There are many agencies with overlapping responsibilities. You have federal and state organizations and governments that establish regulations and laws that govern transit. They provide funding, and it's fairly limited funding, but it has lots and lots of strings attached. You have regional and metropolitan planning organizations that essentially govern the planning process. They prioritize transit construction projects and infrastructure. They work on short and long range transit plans that really govern how transit is going to look over the next, say, 5 to 10 years in most areas. And they may work with local agencies to try to coordinate service policies and procedures. That doesn't always happen. It happens in some regions, and it happens with very mixed results. Some places are a little bit more coordinated than others, and some are quite a bit less coordinated than others. And I would say the LA, there's some level of coordination. San Francisco Bay Area is a lot less coordinated. So, and then you have municipal governments. So transit agencies and local governments, they are really the people who make most operational decisions around transit, and they're the ones who pay for the majority of the cost of service. So they have a pretty big stake, and because they're the ones who pay most of the cost, and because they are the closest to the taxpayers and the voters, they tend to be very cautious about doing things that they're not required by one of these other agencies to do, because they have to answer to people that pay their bills. So on this slide, I basically have, it's easy to get lost, and I've got a picture of a cowboy. He's riding a horse in a really in a kind of a deserted landscape. He's leading a couple of riderless horses, and there's no one else around. And really, these are the questions. Yeah, this is why it is so easy to get lost in transit. What is actually required and what is not? Who has the authority to make the decisions? And then most important, I think, for us is, where should we direct our advocacy efforts? You know, who do we talk to about any given decision? Where do we have the most leverage to try to get certain things dealt with? And that's really what we're going to talk about. So here's our agenda. I've got a black and white target board. It's like a bullseye. And in the bullseye, I've got a blue arrow. So hopefully we'll hit the target today. First, I want to summarize the regulations that impact transit. I want to review ADA transit paratransit requirements a little bit. I want to list some of the transit decisions that happen at the local level. And it's a pretty impressive list, I'll have you know. I want to describe the implications of this structure for the CCB, as well as for local chapters and individuals. And then we will, on the agenda, I have it listed last, but as we go through this presentation, I definitely want to take time to answer your questions and have conversation as much as time permits. And I would ask, is it Andrea, that if I am getting close to about 15 minutes, give me a holler so that I don't go too far. And also, I have we have a door prize to give away during this session as well. I think it's a pretty cool door prize. So if you can stick through the end, it'll be worth it. All right. Well, let's jump in, and we will stop. I'm going to go through a lot of regulatory kind of stuff. So we'll have some times to stop here. If y'all have questions, you know, feel free. So let me just start with federal regulations. And I've got it's a great picture here. There is an old Western sheriff. He's got a gun holster. He's wearing a leather vest and a cowboy hat. And he's looking over his shoulder with a very jaundiced eye, as though he's looking for trouble. So yeah, he's your federal government. He's looking out. He's watching. So the federal government, even though it doesn't deliver, as we'd say in the old West, a lick of transportation, they sure pass a passel of transportation laws. first and foremost, the transportation spending bill. It goes by different names, but the spending bill is basically the bill that governs. It's typically about a 5-year spending horizon, and it really sets the transit spending priorities. It establishes the levels of spending. It establishes how the money can be spent, how it's apportioned. It's really the Bible with regard to funding. The other thing that it does is it defines kind of what lands in what categories. So if something is not in this bill, it is hard to spend federal money on it. So I'll give you an example of a positive. In this particular transit spending bill, there is a pilot program for one-stop paratransit for people that need to make a stop on the way to or from wherever they're going. It's not a very big pilot, but there is funding actually called out so that the industry can do some pilot testing around this. And there actually is in Los Angeles a very small pilot around this right now. And I'm not sure if they're using federal funds. I don't think they are. But you know, when those kinds of programs land in the transportation spending bill, it creates opportunities to advocate on the local level. The second thing that I want to list here is the National Transit Database. That sounds really boring, and it really is boring, except that it's also really, really important. The National Transit Database is a set of statistics that federal transit agencies who receive federal funds are required to fill out as a condition of receiving their funding. They have to do it. And it's really important for two reasons. One, it basically, if you count things, you know, like trips, miles, hours of service, vehicles, cost, if it allows you to count it, then you count it and it affects your funding formula. So it affects the percentage of funding that your agency gets. So agencies like to do things that the National Transit Database tracks and requires them to report. And they don't like to do things that the National Transit Database does not track. Anything that it doesn't track doesn't really count toward their funding allocation. So it's less appealing for them to do those things. The other thing that it does is it gathers statistics. And it's a public, you know, it's a public database. You can go look at it. It's always a couple of years out of date. But there are statistics there about how many trips, what by mode. So there's transit, there's paratransit. You can look at all this stuff. You can look at safety. You can look at cost per mile, cost per hour, cost per trip, all these different metrics that the industry looks at. They're all there and you can look at them and see in theory, you know, you can compare systems with each other. So that's there and it's important and it governs a lot of the activities that transit agencies choose to do. Another thing that the federal government does is FTA, it's Federal Transit Administration, which is who regulates the industry, substance abuse training, testing, and reporting requirements. This is a big deal because anybody who provides public transit that is federally funded with some small caveats is required to meet the requirements of FTA, substance abuse training, testing, and reporting. And this is one of the barriers to entry for things like Uber and Lyft, because they don't provide this, they don't comply with these requirements, and they really have no interest in complying with these requirements. So there are small ways that they can get involved, but it's a barrier to entry for any company that is not willing to meet these requirements. And transit takes it very seriously. They have to report on them every year. They have to provide training. They have to provide the data. So it's taken pretty seriously. There are federal labor protections that transit agencies have to meet. And really what these are designed to do is protect workers and particularly organized workers. So if a transit agency wants to privatize a service, let's say, there are very strict rules on how they're able to do that. They have to protect jobs that are held by public agency employees who are in collective bargaining units. Those protections are built into federal law as in addition to everything else. There are federal third-party contracting guidelines. So the federal government does not tell a transit agency who they have to do business with, but it does tell them what the rules of contracting, some basic rules that they have to meet around competition, around the fact that you can't have a bid without pricing. There are some requirements around how you have to run a procurement process. There has to be a protest procedure. All these things are established in federal law or in federal regulation, actually, and transit agencies do have to take those seriously. I want to talk about the U.S. Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 does a couple of things. I mean, we all know about the fact that it guarantees or prohibits discrimination based on things like race, ethnicity, gender, age. But it also requires transit agencies or prohibits transit agencies from either implementing services or eliminating services that have a disproportionately negative impact on one group over another group. So if a transit agency wants to, say, for example, eliminate service, they have to look at, does that decision disproportionately impact people who are in a class of people that is protected under the U.S. Civil Rights Act? So it really kind of gives them some parameters that they have to follow. And there's some procedures around reporting and around public hearings and participation that they have to meet in order to do those things. So they do pay attention to it. Some agencies pay a little more attention to it. Some agencies check the box, but it is something they have to pay attention to. The ADA and Federal Rehab Act, we're going to talk about the ADA in some detail, but the Federal Rehab Act, which predated it, really establishes the idea of you can't discriminate against people with disabilities in programs that receive federal funds. This is the law that established the requirement for transit to offer discounts on bus and light rail for seniors and for people with disabilities. So that 50% or more fare discount that you get as a person with a disability, if you use the bus or the train in your local community, that comes from the Federal Rehab Act. And it specifically does not apply to paratransit. And there are other federal laws and regulations that I'm not even going to get into because they're detailed, but things like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and Buy America provisions and the there's requirements around doing business with countries that do business with Iran and other recognized terror states. So, I mean, there's a lot of regulation that agencies have to work with. So keep that in mind. And then we have California. And I've got a picture on this slide, two rubber stamps leaning against a stack of papers. Sounds like a government office. One of them says regulations and the other says rules. And California layers on a bunch that adds to the federal pile I just went through. You have additional clean air and emission standards from the California Air Resources Board and elsewhere. You have mandatory fleet and facility inspections of public transit operators by the California Highway Patrol. There are additional labor protections in California around lunch breaks, around you have some protections for additional paid time off for COVID. So the state has a lot of extra rules that frankly make doing business in California cost a little more. And that's not a complaint, it's just a reality. One of the things that you recently had added to the pile was Proposition 22, which provides some protections, I guess, or basic protections for drivers of TNCs like Uber and Lyft, which actually created, raised the cost of those services just a little bit in order to guarantee some benefits to those drivers. You have additional accessibility standards like Title 24, and I think there are probably many others. There are people who can speak to those better than I can. And then finally, you have local living wage ordinances and probably other things as well. But you have several communities in California have minimum wage ordinances that go above either the federal statutory or the state rules. So all of these things are rules that transit must operate in accordance with. So let me just stop there. That's a lot of minutia, and just see if anybody has any questions.
Okay, Andy, go ahead and unmute.
Okay. Rana, I don't know if I misunderstood something you said, but and that's what I want to clear up now. Did you say that companies like Uber and Lyft cannot partner with paratransit agencies because of certain things that they won't live up to?
Yeah. Let me clarify. They can partner under certain circumstances. So for example, the issue I was talking about was federal substance abuse testing and training requirements that the federal government layers onto public transit agencies and any contractor who provides public transit services. The way that some providers, and this would apply to Uber, this would apply to Lyft, this would apply to taxi cabs, is if a customer, if a customer has the ability to opt into a service, they can choose to participate or not. Then an agency can partner with these companies in a limited way, as long as the customer has the ability to opt in or opt out of the service. And this is an area that actually there is a lot of, I wouldn't call it uncertainty, but there's difference of opinion within the industry on what that means. For example, if you opt in once and say, I'm going to use this service, does that mean that the agency can work with these providers and that's it? You've opted in and now that's it. Other agencies take the position that the opt-in has to be kind of on every trip. Other agencies believe that there has to be a choice between providers on every trip. And there's not a lot of clarity at this point for the federal government over what it means. All we know for sure is that services that do not meet FTA requirements can be used as long as the customer has the ability to choose or not choose to use them.
Ron, this is Andrea, and I want to make a quick comment. And this may not be exactly what you're talking about, but I think it's probably related. Mm-hmm. I have transportation provided by my medical insurance. It's because mm-hmm. I have Medicare, uh-huh. Secure Horizons, and it's through them. I get mm-hmm. so many trips a year mm-hmm. For either medical appointments or to go to the pharmacy to pick up prescriptions. Mm-hmm. And they use a lot of private contractors, but they are using Lyft and Uber more and more. Mm-hmm. And the interesting part of this is when I started with them 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I was told that HIPAA prevented them from putting me in a Lyft or Uber vehicle because if I was by myself, because I could not visually identify the driver and confirm that that was the right person who was picking me up. Well, that seems to have changed because now they just put me in Uber and Lyft all the time.
Right. So let me clarify that medical transportation is not covered. We're not talking about that. So,
okay. It's just interesting to me.
Yeah. No, there are at last count 130 federal departments and there are 130 different federal programs that provide some level of funding for transportation. And they are, and they all have different rules. They're not all the same. When I'm talking today, I'm talking about public transportation provided by public transit agencies and authorities. And in some very limited instances, you may have a transit agency that provides service for Medi-Cal, for example. But for the most part, almost without exception, this does not apply to Medi-Cal. It doesn't apply to Medicare, and it doesn't apply to private healthcare insurance.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
And that's a good catch because it is a confusing landscape and just defining what is public transit. So public transit for this presentation is strictly things that are provided by public transit agencies and authorities. And that's it. And it could be operated by contractors, but it's public, it's funded by public transit.
Okay, you have another hand. I don't know if you want to take it now.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, Debbie, go ahead and unmute. You should be able to unmute.
Hi, Ron. Mm-hmm. My question is like my city has mm-hmm. it itself and a little bit of the surrounding area around mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. And it has a service that they call Dash. I know it's not Dash everywhere. Now, they'll go out of the way further than what they propose to be their coverage area to take me to the doctors. Mm-hmm. And in my applying for service from them, they automatically approve me if I have an access account. In this case, it's access for Southern California and mm-hmm. Southern region. Mm-hmm. So is that federally funded? Is that why that's those two are connected?
It's a great question. And you do have this a lot, particularly in the LA area. You have a lot of, you have LA Access, which serves the whole kind of LA County region. And it, you know, kind of touches into, you know, the bordering counties just a little bit, but it's basically LA County. And then you have a lot of communities in Los Angeles County that have community dial-a-rides or dashes or whatever, that, you know, they go by a lot of different names. Those programs are typically funded pretty much by the city itself. They may have some community block grant money that's federal, or they may have some, they may do some other things that bring in some other federal money, but it's probably not federal transit money. And they typically do not have to meet the requirements that transit has to meet. Which, by the way, means that those services are also not mandated at all. I mean, typically those are determined locally. A local community decides that they want to have some additional service. It's, a lot of times those programs have been around for a long time, and they were started for seniors, and they've just been kind of kept around. Or maybe it's a case where a city doesn't feel that the regional paratransit system meets all of the needs of its constituents, and so it has its own program that kind of supplements what a regional paratransit provider does.
Debbie, you had another question. Go ahead.
Let's see if I can state this correctly. And in terms of the funding and how, what kind of service I receive, yes, LA County versus Orange County. And mm-hmm. I have been lucky to have full service in Orange County, even though I live in LA County, mm-hmm. but in part because I worked in Orange County. Mm-hmm. is that, you know, is that a tax kind of a thing? Now, this is Orange County access in the same way as LA counties. It's just, yeah.
It doesn't have to do with your taxes. We'll talk about paratransit eligibility in a minute. Well, in a few minutes. But no, that is actually not, it doesn't have anything to do with what you pay. You can actually be eligible in lots of places at once, and that's perfectly fine. So,
okay. Thank you. Okay.
Why don't we jump into a little bit more specifically the ADA requirements for public transit. And I got to change slides here. Yeah. Hopefully I'm on the right slide. ADA requirements for fixed route transit. And the first bullet here I say is what it is and what it ain't. Let me just explain what that means. When the ADA was adopted back in 1990, and the regs came into effect in 1992, but when it was written, there was most transit agencies provided fixed route public transit. It was buses, maybe some light rail, and maybe they had a little bit of other stuff, but basically you had a bus network. And you have maybe had some light rail stations, and that was what most agencies offered. And so the ADA, and when you get down to talk about paratransit, it's tied to fixed route. So it's really important to know what fixed route transit is. Fixed route is local bus service that operates on a fixed schedule, and that operates during a base period of service. Let me tell you some of the things that are not considered fixed route transit, because these were not significant pieces of service in 1990. They are much more significant now. Microtransit did not exist in 1990. It wasn't even a concept. So microtransit, which you're starting to see some, Sacramento has some microtransit. There's a little bit of microtransit in the Bay Area and Contra Costa County. There's probably some that I don't know about. Microtransit is not considered fixed route transit. Express bus service. So a bus that if you're in an outlying suburb and you take like almost like an over the road bus, or even if it's a transit bus, but you get it at like a park and ride or maybe at a train station, and it goes straight downtown and it only runs in the mornings, to the city, and in the evenings back out, that's commuter service. that is not considered fixed route transit. So when we get to talk about paratransit in a little bit, that's an important distinction. So let's talk specifically about fixed route public transit. And this is stuff that a lot of you probably already know. So I'm not going to spend much time on it unless you have questions. There are accessibility standards for fleets and facilities. Basically, it has to be accessible to and usable by people with disabilities as defined by the law. There are requirements for audio and visual delivery of a route's destination if the route, if it's at a stop serving multiple routes. So if you're at a downtown transit center, the transit agency has to make destination announcements on each bus or, you know, each train that serves that area. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. It is a requirement that they do so. Of course, stop announcements, we've been talking about those back since, as long as I've been in the industry, so probably way before that as well. Transit agencies are required to announce stops, and they can do that either by the driver making the announcement or by technology at major stops, at transfer points, points of interest, and anywhere that a person with a disability requests. So that is something that the law does require them to do. Priority seating near the front of buses and near entrance doors of rail cars. One of the things about this that's important to keep in mind is they're required to reserve the seats. They are not permitted to force people to move so that a person with a disability can occupy the seat. And it's important to know that because we don't, you know, a lot of people have hidden disabilities. It's not the transit agency's they don't have the ability to know who might need that seat or who might not. All they are responsible for doing is designating the seats as priority seats and asking people to make them available to people with disabilities who need them and seniors. Deploying the lift or the ramp upon request, and that's for any person. You do not have to be in a mobility device. You do not have to be in a wheelchair. If your system has kneelers, it's not required by law because kneelers didn't really exist in 1990. But I certainly, when I talk to transit agencies, I treat that the same way. Anything that allows people to eat more easily and more accessibly board, if they have the technology, they're supposed to use it for any person who needs it upon request. So here's guaranteeing access for service animals. I mean, people with service animals. I mean, I don't think most transit agencies on their fixed route transit system have a problem with this. Usually it's pretty good. If anything, we have the opposite problem of too many transit agencies allowing people to bring animals that are not service animals who aren't under control and who create a hazard for those of us who have service animals. But the agencies are required to guarantee access for service animals. That is a topic all by itself. So I won't camp there unless somebody really wants to. Access to customer-facing information. This is an interesting one. The Department of Transportation, which regulates transit, has never been super clear about what this means. And you know, back when everything was written down, if an agency had a call center, they were they were golden. They could just do that, and that was fine. Now that agencies are moving more and more toward online information, digital, mobile apps, digital payment. This is getting a little bit less clear. Transit agencies are putting up websites that aren't always accessible. They're releasing mobile apps that don't always work very well. And people are getting frustrated. And now what we're starting to see is the U.S. Department of Justice, which reserves the right to step in if it chooses, is now starting to pay attention to digital accessibility by public agencies. And that would potentially include transit. They have intervened in the past. It's still not clear if they're going to intervene again or if they're going to intervene in a bigger way. But I think this is an area where we have the opportunity and we may have the timing to start to really push a little bit harder on digital accessibility, because I think the Department of Justice is friendly to this issue right now. So this is something that, you know, we can certainly, again, this is a topic that can kind of take over a meeting, but you do have the right to customer facing information. And I would argue that you have the right to that information when it's presented digitally or in a mobile app. You can assert a right to have that app or that website be accessible. Effective maintenance of accessibility related equipment. That is a requirement in the law. So if you have a stop announcement system and it never works, there actually is an expectation that you should fix it. So, you know, those, when you're on a bus and stops aren't being announced because it's broken, it's not sufficient for the driver to just mumble that it's broken. They have to either maintain the equipment or the driver has to make the announcements. And then finally, appropriate training for people who have a responsibility for delivering service. They have to be trained appropriately to work with people with disabilities and to deliver the agency's responsibilities under the ADA. So it is critical that training be provided and be provided in a way that makes it effective. And if an agency staff is routinely not doing a very good job, that probably, you know, is an issue for training. Any questions about fixed route transit requirements under ADA before I go to paratransit?
You do have a hand. I'm going to hold on just a minute. Okay, Shayna, you may unmute.
Okay, you said that microtransit isn't fixed route transit, but what is it?
Microtransit is basically an on-demand service for the general public that operates with an app. So imagine a small community like a suburb that's near a transit, like maybe a train station, and there's not enough people to really run like a bus. So the agency will contract with a third party, or maybe they'll run it themselves with some technology. They'll put out a vehicle and they'll run that service, and it's on demand with an app. And usually you can call and request it too. Often those services, so that's microtransit. There is no requirement to use paratransit in that same area. Microtransit is not fixed route. It doesn't run on a schedule. It doesn't run on a preset route. So it is not fixed route. Let me just clarify. It is microtransit. It's not fixed route. It's micro. That's what it is. It is its own thing. It didn't exist in 1990 when the law was written. So the transit agencies have to make their services accessible to people with disabilities. So for example, with microtransit, if a system has an app that's not accessible, they have to make a phone option available. If they have vehicles that aren't wheelchair accessible, they may use paratransit only for people who can't use those vehicles. It is not, what all I'm meaning to tell you is that it is not fixed route. It doesn't carry a requirement for paratransit to be operated in the same area. Someone else had a question.
Sarah, do you want Steve to go first, or do you want me to take the hands first?
I think it's absolutely fine for Steve to jump in.
Right, okay, now. Go ahead, Steve. I'm sorry. I just wanted to make sure.
Okay. Ron, my question is Metrolink services like that considered fixed route? And the reason I ask that is because LA Access, as you know, a lot of our complaints center around long trips with them, and their response has always been an access trip can take as long as the same trip on. It used to be the bus or the train. I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, they changed that to just the bus, and that significantly increased the amount of time that, you know, we can be in an access vehicle, because there's a lot of trips in LA that are faster if they're a combination of bus and Metrolink.
So my understanding, and I've ridden Metrolink, my understanding is Metrolink is a train. It is, you know, it's a big train that runs on like a track, and you climb up in it and it, you know, choo choo, and it runs down the tracks. So it's a train, right? If it's a train, it's not fixed route. They are within their legal right to do that. The exception, so if you have light rail, okay, because typically light rail operates within an urban setting, and like Sacramento has light rail, San Jose has light rail. I think LA, I mean, doesn't LA have some light rail? So light rail, that's its own, that typically is viewed as fixed route service because it's serving a community. But Metrolink is more like commuter rail, and it's not covered. I mean, it doesn't carry a paratransit requirement.
Not the answer I wanted to hear, but thank you.
Yep.
Okay. We've got several hands. So Ron, you tell me.
Let's take three and then keep going. I just want to be careful with time.
Okay. Area code 626. You may unmute.
Am I unmuted, Andrea?
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead, Pam.
Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
Hi, Ron, and I don't believe Arizona is another country. I love it. I wish I could be there. anyway, my question has to do with what you were mentioning regarding reserved seating, I guess. Mm-hmm. And you were saying that there's an announcement to reserve seating for seniors or disabled. But if someone takes the seat, we don't know if their disability is hidden. So in effect, there's not really a way to reserve, right?
It's not reserved seating, it's priority seating. So all it means is they designate it with a sign, and most systems also make announcements. And the law requires signs. It doesn't even require announcements. And the agency is not allowed to require people to move. So it's really kind of on the honor system. I will tell you that, and it can be embarrassing, quite frankly, sometimes drivers will just, you know, because the law doesn't actually require them to drive the bus. There are drivers out there, and I'm not sure I advise this necessarily, but they will literally park the bus and say, fine, I'm not moving the bus. I can't tell you to move, but I'm not moving either. And sometimes passengers will get involved and ask people to move, and it gets a little bit awkward. But yeah, that is a reality. It is not something the agencies can really enforce. They can only ask.
Thank you so very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Shaneer Derrick, you may unmute.
Hi. All right. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
All right. I had a question with paratransit.
We're going to get there next.
Something you...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So you want me to ask it right now or you want me to wait till later?
No, hold on, because we got a lot of paratransit to get to next. So one more. Okay.
Andy, go ahead. You may unmute.
Okay. Okay. This kind of piggybacks on Pam's question. And that is that suppose you have a scenario where you have a person in a wheelchair waiting to get on the bus, and it's a crowded bus, and they want to come on, and the driver asks the people in the side facing seats, you know, to move, or one of them to move so that he can fold down the seat or whatever. And the people don't move. What happens to that guy in the wheelchair? He can't get on the bus.
So in that instant, and one of the things that a best practice for agencies, and actually Phoenix is an example of this, they actually have the flip down seats for wheelchairs in a different part of the bus. And they have and the wheelchair ramp is actually on the second door for this very reason, so that there's not conflicts between priority seating and wheelchair seating. In practice, it's a pretty esoteric. I'm trying to think if I know the official, you know, book, chapter, verse answer, and I don't know if I do. In practice, what happens is agencies are pretty pretty firm about this. If they take the position that those priority seats do not often they don't always include the seats that are flipped down. So I'm thinking, for example, and I'm thinking of a couple of different configurations. Typically, the seats in the front of the bus are over the wheel wells, and those are not flip downs. The seats behind those are typically the flip downs, and those seats are typically reserved. Those seats are not typically priority seats, so drivers can insist that people move. I know that there's a lot of bus configurations. There are some older buses, low floors, where what I'm saying is not true. In practice, agencies are pretty aggressive about this when there's a wheelchair involved because of the pass up issue. I'm not sure if it came to court where it would land. So let's go on to paratransit. So lots of paratransit. I've got a picture on this slide of your typical, I've got a typical paratransit van on this slide. It's I'll tell you, paratransit looks different in different communities, but in most communities, paratransit is a van. It's got a lift or a ramp. It holds a bunch of people and it runs around in circles. Sometimes the circles make sense, sometimes they don't. So let's talk about what and there are exceptions. I mean, there are some cities that are starting and some have done it for a while. I mean, LA has gone back and forth with taxis. Orange County has some alternative programs that use taxis and some other providers. Sacramento is starting to do some stuff with the TNC. So there are exceptions, but most paratransit is in vans. And here's what the law requires. So first off, paratransit is available to people who meet eligibility requirements. Those requirements are set at the federal level, but they are essentially administered at the local level. So the law basically says you're eligible if you have a disability that prevents you from using fixed route public transportation some or all of the time. And that includes, by the way, getting to and from transit. So I've heard many, many times in many places that people believe that agencies discriminate against blind people. If they do, they're breaking the law, because as a person who's blind or visually impaired, you almost certainly are eligible, at least for some trips, based on the fact of getting to and from transit in unfamiliar areas and areas with complicated street environments. So, I mean, that's a topic all by itself, but you certainly are likely to be eligible. And you have an appeal right under federal law as well. So under federal law, if you do not get granted, we have somebody who's not on mute. If you could mute, that would be great. So if you apply for eligibility and you're denied as a person who's blind or visually impaired, you probably have the right to an appeal. We can take those questions if they come up. Service must be available in the same areas and during the same hours as fixed route transit. If you remember, I said it's fixed route transit. So if you're in an area that is served by a commuter rail, or if you're in an area that is served by an express bus and there's no local bus service, or if you're in an area that has microtransit but no other bus service, there's no requirement for paratransit in those areas. If your transit system runs bus hours on, you know, from say 6 in the morning till 6 in the evening, and they have a commuter route that starts earlier, there's no bus service, there's no paratransit requirement for that. It's only in the areas and during the hours that local fixed route transit service operates. Of course, paratransit's available on at least the next day basis. Some systems provide some same day service. It's not mandated by law. The law requires that if you want to travel to tomorrow, they have to accept your trip request today. Service is available within 1 hour of the time that the customer requests. And this is a big deal, because if you think about it, you want to get picked up at 7 a.m. That means they can offer you anything from 6 to 8. And if you don't take it, that's on you. It's not them. They have a right to offer you anything from 6 to 8 for that 7 a.m. pickup. The only exception to that, and this is not in the law, but it's in interpretation, is they can't violate the obvious and purpose of the trip. So if you tell the agency, I need to get to work by 8, and I need to get picked up after 3 because I finished work at 3, they can't offer you times that by design are gonna basically cause you not to be able to go to work. So they can't offer you, for example, a pickup time that would by definition get you to work after your work start time. And they can't offer you a return time that's before you told them your shift is ending. So this is something that a lot of agencies are sloppy with. It's something that you should know and pay close attention to. The law says there's no waiting lists and no denials. They can't deny a trip if it's during, you know, if it's an ADA eligible customer making an ADA eligible trip. They have to honor it. They can't deny it ever, as long as it's, you know, during the service hours and in the service area. And there's no waiting list. They can't tell you, you know, I'm sorry, we're full, call back tomorrow, or put you on a list. So one thing that's not on the slide, and I'll clarify it, subscription trips are not required by law. So a lot of transit agencies will establish waiting lists for subscription trips. And they're allowed to do that because there is no legal requirement for them to provide a standing order, a subscription trip. They go by different names, but they're not required. They're really in transit's best interest because it helps them plan service. But some of them still hold on to the idea that that they don't have to do it, and so they limit it. Service must be door-to-door if door-to-door is needed by the rider. a lot of systems, I know LA Access in particular, used to be very strict curb to curb. Door to door is not required unless the customer needs it. And they can require you to have eligibility that proves that you need door to door. But if you need the driver to come to the door and meet you, and you've established that you need that because of your disability, the transit agency does have a legal requirement to provide it. So we can talk about that if you have questions, but that is something that a lot of people don't know. And a lot of transit systems don't do a great job of communicating that to their customers. Here's a big one. We talked about it already. Travel times are limited to the time that the same trip would take on fixed route transit. So this is the LA thing with the commuter rail. Commuter rail don't count because it's not fixed route transit. So they can tie that trip length to the time that it would take to make that trip on a bus. But here's something to think about. If you live in an area like, and LA might not be the best example, the Bay Area would be a better example. You live in San Mateo County and you're going to, let's say, Concord or Antioch. That trip can be made on public transit. It's going to take you a couple of hours to make it. But on paratransit, that trip probably requires two transfers. The ADA says that trip on paratransit, transfers and all, cannot exceed the time that trip would take to make on public transit. And by the way, BART is considered a fixed route transit system. It is not a commuter rail system. It is definitely a fixed route transit system. Service cannot charge more than twice the transit fare for the same trip. And I'm going to just stop on this one. This is the one piece of requirement that is explicitly in the ADA that strikes me as wrong. I mean, there's others, but this one is blatant because we are literally telling people that cannot use a bus or a train that they have to pay twice as much so they can go somewhere. And that strikes me as unfair. And I think in 1990, I can tell you this was a compromise. It was a political deal that was made to get the law passed because transit was afraid that many, many people would use paratransit. So they basically said, you know, we need to negotiate. We need to have a way of keeping people from using it if they don't need it. And they decided to tie that to, make it expensive and then people won't do it. But it's in the law, and so they can do it, and many systems do it, and some get in trouble because they don't do it very effectively, LA. So what I'm telling you is this is one where, and we'll talk about what states can do, this is one where the law gives them permission to do something that I think is pretty questionable, given the fact that most people who have disabilities are on fixed incomes, and we're asking them to pay twice as much as people who are paying an undiscounted fare on public transit. Pretty strange. And then finally, riders can travel with a personal care attendant if they need it, and at least one companion. The PCA is free. The companions pay the same fare as the rider. And this is another area where transit agencies can sometimes get confused. A personal care attendant is not someone that the rider needs in order to make a trip. It's somebody that the rider needs in order to help them with functions of daily living. So if you're going to the store and you want to take somebody with you who can help you shop, that person does count as a PCA. So when you're thinking about your eligibility for paratransit, think broadly about what you use a PCA for. And a PCA can be any person. If you need somebody to help you read, to navigate, to shop, whatever that person is doing, those are all PCA functions. And if you can speak to those in the eligibility process, you do have a legal right to have a PCA, and that person then could travel with you at no additional charge. Let me stop there and just ask if we have any questions on that content.
It's about 2 minutes to the hour and you have 4 hands at the moment.
Let's take them all, but let's go quick. One question okay. per person, let's go.
All right, just 1 second here. I'm sorry, my internet is very slow. I don't know what's happening. I'm having a really hard time getting, just 1 second, please.
Larry, can you assist?
Okay, Charlene, you should be able to unmute. Please go ahead.
Awesome.
I got her.
Oh, okay, I'm unmuted.
Yep, you are.
There you go, sweetie. Thank you.
Ron, I have a question for you in talking about the paratransit using taxis to assist them with filling schedules. Because the ADA says that a person in a wheelchair needs to have the same service as a person who does not need a wheelchair, how are companies, transit companies, proving that by using taxis, they are not giving a priority to people who can use a taxi and not a require a lift?
So good question. The issue is it's around equity, and what is typically looked at is travel time and response time. So if a person in a wheelchair has a fundamentally lower quality of service over time, their trips take longer. At some point, then the agency has to explain how that service is equitable. If it's not equitable, then it can create a challenge for the agency. This is an area that's evolving. The law is not real clear, but typically they're going to look at service quality as the metric. Next question.
Okay, Sheila Gunn Cushman, you should be able to unmute.
Hi, this is Joshua Saunders, and
oh, go ahead, Josh. Okay, go ahead.
Ron, I was asking. I know that paratransit is tied to fixed route transit. And one thing I've always wondered is why does it work that way? Why is it limited to only those things?
This is my personal belief. I wasn't there. I was in college drinking beer. Oh, never mind. That's a different story. So what I believe probably happened is if you think about the history of the ADA, it really came from the same set of movements that brought the Civil Rights Act. And so the idea here is that the ADA was intended to provide the same access to the service that other people received. And because the transit industry had the requirements under the Federal Rehab Act, the advocates focused on transit. They didn't focus on the rest of the transportation landscape because they just didn't focus on it. They were focused on trying to fix transit, which was very broken under the Rehab Act. And so they used civil rights logic to say, we have the same right to transportation, public transportation, as everybody else does. And I really think that's what happened. I personally think it's an accident of history. I don't think there's any logical reason other than it's just how it turned out.
Because it really seems to limit what we have access to, because we're only access to what's fixed route access versus, what people can do with a car.
Yes.
I know that some agencies have tried to use Uber or Lyft, at least I've heard, as a temporary measure or something. Mm-hmm. Has there been any progress in that regard?
There has, but not most transit agencies limit their service to where they operate. There are some cities that approach things differently. When I was here in the Phoenix area, we approached it a bit differently, but that's because our cities here in the region provided most of the funding and most of the decision-making. So we took a slightly different tack, but most transit agencies are focused on the areas where they operate. And again, remember that agencies can only count what they can, they only can count what the federal government says they can count. And they don't like to do anything that they can't count because it affects their funding formula. So these are things that we have to work through as advocates. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. Okay. So real quickly, we had two more questions.
Okay, Sheila Gunn Cushman, you should be unmuted.
I am.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you. In Alameda County, AC Transit, which is our biggest transit system, is having a love affair with BRT. Bus Rapid Transit.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a couple of related questions. One, is BRT considered fixed route or is it something else?
I would argue that it It's a very good question. I would argue that it's going to be considered something else, even though I would argue that it should be considered transit, fixed route. And I'm not sure if the industry has fully answered that question. It did not exist when the ADA was written, so it's gray.
The other thing, a related thing, is I would like to see a lot more integrated stuff where micro can lead to fixed route and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't, it's a long story. I can't use Uber and Lyft reliably. And I can't, I also can't wear a mask. I can wear a shield. That's been a problem. Paratransit's flip-flopped a lot around that.
Yep.
But I am trying to, I can't do scented products, and right, everybody loves their air fresheners, and I don't.
Yep.
Help.
Yep. No, it's a tough issue, and the ADA doesn't specifically address chemical sensitivity, which was pretty controversial even back then, and I would say that that's probably an issue you're going to have to wrestle at the local level, and we can talk about that when we get to local a little bit. Let me take the last question before, and then we need to keep going.
Okay, Chanel Garrett. Go ahead.
All right, it's me again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a question about I think it was will calls. Is there a set time where will calls have to be served? Because our current, where I'm at, we have will calls to where it's 5 to 90 minutes. So is there any,
yep,
is that based on a standard, or is that just,
it's those are completely local. They're not required by the ADA. They can do whatever they want.
Oh wow.
Now that doesn't mean you can't advocate, but it does mean that the law doesn't cover it.
Yeah, well, me and my blonde friend, we've been talking about that needs to be advocated because it's a little ridiculous, right, where we're at. Yeah. Thank you.
Let's keep going. All right. These are great questions, by the way. I wish we had more time.
Because it doesn't.
Okay, I'm going to continue on. I don't want to
deal with having to set something up a day in advance.
Okay.
Guys, yep, guys.
For God knows when.
Let's go ahead. Yeah, let's guys, go ahead and mute it. I heard the comment and I agree. This is part of why I believe in on-demand paratransit. Who lives their life a day in advance? If you've been a parent, you aren't living your life a day in advance, I can tell you right now. Next slide here is what is decided locally. And I've got a nice little picture here of a green street sign, and process and avenue and procedure street. So all transit operating policies and procedures are determined locally. And I'll repeat it, all are determined locally. Now they have to meet the requirements of the law. Okay, they can't violate state or federal law, but they are determined locally. There's a transit board, there's a city council, depends on how your agency is structured. They make those decisions and then staff carries them out. And the degree to which staff, makes decisions is determined by how the board works. I can tell you, for example, at LA Access, I mean, it's my opinion that the staff has a lot of authority to set policy and procedure, and the board, they certainly have a say, but the staff has a lot of authority to kind of govern how things get done. And I'd say the same is probably true for SAC-RT. I know some of the agencies in California better than others, but so here are the things that agencies at the local level determine: when and where public transit and public transit operates, and ultimately when and where paratransit operates too. Service types offered, and that's a big deal. An agency can decide, for example, we don't want to run a local bus route in this area because we don't have enough ridership. Let's cut that route and let's have microtransit instead. And when they do, that changes the paratransit requirement as well. They determine things like the fares and methods of payment. And that's a pretty big deal because they set the fare and they can totally set the fare wherever they want it for fixed route. Paratransit is tied to it up to twice as much, but they also set the methods of payment. So, and this is one of those things where we see a lot of discrepancy between the methods that are available to customers who use transit or rail or express bus or commuter rail. And in paratransit, in many places, it's still tied to tickets and cash and you can't do anything else. And it's very, very different looking when you're in paratransit, usually not as good. Who provides the service? That's determined locally. They have to meet federal guidelines for contracting, but they get to decide who their provider is, and they do not have to get permission for that. So many of the paratransit policies are also determined locally. Eligibility, for example, is absolutely determined at the local level. The law says who is eligible, but the agency decides what the process looks like, whether it's an application or an interview. You know, how long is the eligibility period? Is there an auto renewal, or do you have to go through the whole process every 3 years? Those are all local decisions made locally. When and where service operates, that's determined again locally. It has to meet the requirements of the ADA, but it's beyond that is a local decision. The fares, again, local. As long as they don't exceed twice the regular fare, they can do that. Methods of payment, also local. Who provides the service? So if they contract out, they can decide who the contractor is. And then the last thing on the slide I list is ADA reasonable modifications and complaint procedures. We haven't talked about ADA reasonable modifications, and we don't have time today, but the law entitles people with disabilities to request modifications to policies and procedures if they need the modification to use the service, and getting door-to-door service in a curb-to-curb system would be an example. But the procedures for how that works are all set locally. So, and that's important because, and as we're going to now jump into the implications for CCB and for individuals, the first thing is that almost all advocacy is local. I mean, you know, we advocate at the federal level for things like funding, for things like, you know, big changes to federal laws. You know, those are federal efforts, but most other issues are local. They are things that you can advocate for within the community that you are in. So let me just talk about what the CCB, what I think the CCB is well positioned to do as an affiliate. To help the local chapters and individuals, and then I'll get to the local chapters after that. I think the CCB is in an excellent position to provide transit-specific advocacy training. And you know, if the CCB has the expertise, you can provide it directly. If you don't, you can help, you know, find people to provide it. But, you know, it's a fairly complicated topic, and it's a topic that the CCB is certainly, through conferences like this one, and elsewhere, you know, you have the ability to provide this training and then bring people to it so they can become more effective as local advocates. I think the CCB is well positioned to provide technical support to local chapters and individuals when they have transit issues and they need some help. Some of these issues are pretty detailed and they're pretty specific, and you know, they can be a little bit murky. And I think that the CCB is in a good position to kind of be a clearinghouse to help with those issues that are just a little bit harder, that maybe someone at the local level might not have the answer for. Coordinating state level advocacy efforts when they're needed. And I'll give you an example. Paratransit fares are set by federal law. They can't exceed twice the fare of transit. There have been states in the past that got state level legislation. Washington State was one of them, and I don't know if it's still in effect. I think they might have dumped it during the 2010 recession. But in Washington State, for a time, the state had a law that said you can't charge a paratransit customer more than you charge a transit customer. And they did that because they felt that it was not fair. And so I think there are certain kinds of issues that an affiliate like CCB can advocate for at a state level, because agencies do have to meet state law if they exceed ADA requirements. And then finally is assisting with litigation when it's needed. And there are times when, and I know I don't know if you've done it with transit, but CCB has certainly gotten involved when there is a local issue where there's a problem and it's not getting resolved in the way that it should. The CCB can certainly step in and help those local chapters and help those individuals who need that help. So those are things that I think the affiliate can do. And now what I want to do is talk about what individuals and local chapters are well positioned to do. And on this slide, this might be the only controversial picture. I've got a black and white photo here of a bunch of men standing around with guns and looking confident. Sounds like Arizona, but actually the reason I picked it is because as local transit, as local chapters, you're on the front lines. You guys are the ones who are going to have to fight these battles. And no, don't take guns to the transit meetings. They don't like it when you do that. But you are the ones who have to fight these battles. And here are some of the things that I think you can do at the local chapter level or as individuals that can be effective. One is attend advocacy boards and committees, regional policy and planning committees. You know, all these meetings that happen locally, chapters ought to be in them. And I will tell you, my entire transit career, all of it, 100%, is because of the Alameda County chapter of the CCB back in the day. They needed somebody to go sit at BART Accessibility Task Force meetings. And I volunteered because I was so frustrated with the service that I was receiving at the time that I volunteered because I thought they might actually listen. And I got in and got interested and got into the career. And now I've never not, it's my whole career. So you know, get people to these meetings. This is where things happen. It's where input gets collected. You need to be in the room. Second is participate on those local transit boards and committees. It's one thing to sit in a meeting and share and provide comment. It's a whole nother thing to be sitting at the table, speaking up and casting votes when there's an opportunity to cast votes. It is super important for us, and it's really tiring and exhausting, but it's super important to be at the table. sorry, my voice is starting to give out of me a little bit. Speak up. So speak up when service needs are not being met. Individuals should continuously and always file comments, and I would say compliments as well as complaints when there's a reason to do so. But chapters can also speak. Chapters can write letters to the board of a transit agency. Chapters can you know, circulate petitions. Speak up when there's a problem. Be heard. It'll strengthen the voices of your members. It'll strengthen the voices of other people that are speaking up. You know, you guys as chapters speak for many people, so use that voice at the local level to raise issues when they need to get raised. Designate local members to be transit advocacy experts and get them trained. And I probably should have listed this first. I personally believe that any chapter of any size should have at least one person who is actually like designated to be the transit, you know, kind of advocate or one of several, if you can have several, and get them trained. Just sending people to meetings to sit and report is not effective. People who speak up at meetings and when they don't know what they're talking about, don't have credibility, they're not heard. So if you want to be in these meetings, take the time, make the investment to get them trained so that when they're at these meetings, they can say the right things, be effective, and speak with knowledge behind what they say. Next, share challenges and successes with other local chapters and with the CCB as a whole. You know, have communication, have a communication channel so that people can share information back and forth. And this is really important in areas where you have chapters that are all in the same kind of ecosystem. So like the LA area, you know, everybody, if you're in the LA Access service area, which is huge, there are several CCB chapters there. You guys should be coordinating your efforts so that you're speaking with one voice and not working accidentally against each other's intentions. So I'm going to just get to my last slide. This is my contact slide, and I will send contact information. Actually, Sarah has it, so you can feel free to share. This is my information. I'm happy to answer questions, you know, up to the, you know, assuming I have the answers. So feel free, just for purposes of those of you who want it, if you want to reach out, my Accessible Avenue kind of public facing contact information is connect@accessibleavenue.net. That's connect@accessibleavenue is all one word, .net. And I'm certainly happy to engage with people if you have questions or concerns or, you know, any other kinds of needs. So I will stop there. I don't know how much time we have left. I do want to draw a door prize. Why don't we do that? And then we can take questions. I think, was it Lisa who's drawing that door prize? I can't remember.
Yes. So door prize lady, Vanna Thomas, Vanna Lisa. What did I call you earlier?
You call me a lot of things, Sarah.
So you want to tell everybody about the door prize, or do you want Lisa to read the description, Ron?
Let Lisa do it. I need to give my voice a rest for a second. So
take a breath, get some water.
Yeah.
All right. You're on, Vanna Lisa.
So do I have the description?
It's what I forwarded to you.
If you don't have it handy, I can just describe it because I know we're tight for time. So
Could you please?
Yes, I will. And I'm going to try to do this. I'm not going to be able to read it. I don't have it open. But basically what this is, we have a local candy company called Soretta's Gourmet Chocolate. And this is a set of three different kinds of their chocolates. The French mints. There's some solid chocolates that are different shape, Western shapes. I think they have like cowboy boots and the map of Arizona and maybe something else. I can't remember. Maybe stars. I'm not sure. And then there's one other kind of chocolate. I forget what it is, but it's three kinds of chocolate that they're known for. It'll be shipped to you. So once we draw this, I'm going to be giving your contact information. I'll reach out to you by email and we'll make plans so that you can receive your door prize. So without further ado, go ahead.
Okay. And the winner of the chocolate is Jason Holloway.
Woo, Jason.
All right. So we'll be in touch within the next day or so to make arrangements. I don't know what time it is. Oh, we have about 10 minutes for questions. So we got 10 minutes. So go ahead and let's take as many as we can.
Okay. I have no hands at the moment, but I'm sure they're coming. Okay. Anson. Oh, go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. Ron, I hear your call to action. I guess my question is, where do we get the training? I've been to a lot of access meetings and there's a lot of crazy questions. So where do you recommend somebody start?
So, you know, I mean, first off, that's kind of what this was intended to be. So, I mean, if there's a topic that CCB wants to dive into a little deeper, you know, this is one avenue. There are other people that provide this training. So, I mean, I think I'd be happy to, you know, work with CCB if they were to say, hey, we need a training on this topic to either help you find it, help you provide it, or figure out, you know, where you can get it. So
that's great to hear. Thank you.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Okay, Anthony, you should be able to. Okay, there you are.
Button. Yeah. Actually, Steve asked my question, which is, as being in a local chapter, I would like to know where we can go for this training.
Yep. Got it. Okay. Awesome.
Okay. One moment. Okay. Sheila, go ahead and unmute.
Hey there.
Hey.
So Oakland has a voucher program for its local paratransit. Problem is, it's all in print and they use taxis, which I don't know if they'll use sense or not, but I'm not able to communicate well. They have a phone number. They never answer it. It's probably partly due to COVID, people not being in offices, et cetera, et cetera. And it's quite frustrating. We have a Mayor's Commission on Persons with Disabilities. I can speak to them. I can CC their staff and, you know, show, I can write a letter to these other people if I can find an address for them. I don't know if I've got one. Recommendations.
I think you're on the right track. I mean, if it's a local city voucher program, it's probably not covered under, I mean, it's they have to be able to they, even though it's not a transit program per se, it still has to meet general ADA non-discrimination requirements. So
well, yeah, isn't it under programmatic access?
Yes. So I think you can, I think what you're doing is the right thing to do. You know, these programs, remember, if it's a city program, the one thing you didn't mention is call your city council member. I don't know if Oakland's are at large or if they're by district, but, you know, start, if you're not getting help from staff.
And my district wants things, but anyway.
Well, you got to use the tools you got. I mean, you got a mayor, you got a city council member.
She's better.
Yep.
Yeah, anyway. And Ron, this is Sarah. If I may add one more piece, is so it's like some of the programs that are like that may be funded in a different way. I would really start by finding out how that is funded, because we have a program here in our county that like that that is funded under different kinds of funds, and so you have to go a little bit in a different direction. So
let me go to the
funders.
Well, hold on. Yeah, let me clarify that. And I don't disagree with you, but I do want to clarify it. So funding, the people who fund service may have rules, but the people who answer to voters are the people who make decisions. So I personally think, yes, find out the funding, because you may have leverage through a funder, and you should always, I mean, you know, take that effort. But at the end of the day, if it is a local program that is provided locally and it's approved by a council, like a city council or a county commission or whoever, public politicians who got voted into office voted for it. They answer to you as a voter. Never give up your power. You know, people who fund programs, I'm not trying to be rude, but they're bureaucrats. They don't answer to voters. People in elected office at the local level do answer to voters, and they are usually pretty responsive. I'd probably do both. I'd find out who the funding is, contact the funders. If you don't get satisfaction, you can always go to the policy level next, which is your board committee. It's your board or your city council or whoever. By the way, there are other tools.
Okay.
Social media is a tool. The media can be a tool. I mean, there are other tools too, and we haven't really talked about those, but I would definitely always, personally, I always believe local is the best kind of advocacy, because you're talking to people in your community who have a stake in the outcome.
Okay. Area code 626, I believe it's Pampology. Go ahead. You should be unmuted.
Thank you, Andrea. And it is I. This is the Arizona wannabe again. In a situation, if you have a set time that paratransit is supposed to pick you up at the end of your trip, the establishment which you were visiting is now closed. So they gave me an 8:20 p.m. I called at that time, and they said it would be 45 minutes to call back in 15. I called back in 15, and they said it would be an hour and a half. So I spoke with a supervisor who just kept saying, like I said, it'll be an hour and a half several times. What, I don't know if this is a local issue or because I know they used to send other vendors if they didn't have any.
Who's the provider? Available. Is this Access?
Yes.
I'd file a complaint with Access.
And I did.
Okay. And if Access can't solve the problem, I would probably escalate this to, the Access board. And then I would also elevate it to the U.S. Federal Department of Transportation of the Office of Civil Rights. And we didn't really talk about, like, I didn't go into a bunch of like book, chapter, verse on who to call and where and when. But, you know, these kinds of things are happening a lot right now because of driver shortages and COVID and all the things that are going on. And they're putting people at risk. It's unsafe. So I would actually probably, if they're not getting you an answer, and if it, you know, once in a while, if it happens, it happens. But if it keeps happening, I think I would probably first off document it every time it happens, even if you don't complain, because the first thing that the federal regulators are going to ask you is to show me a pattern of this happening. And if you can't demonstrate that it's happening regularly, they're not going to take much interest.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Charlene, I believe you're unmuted. Go ahead.
And Charlene will be our last.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Sarah.
This is a grasping at what should be done and isn't done. I keep trying to put out to where I'm speaking to on committees and stuff that it is unfair to a person with a disability that their paratransit is terminated because a bus was terminated. And that is because when people move and live somewhere, they look for a place that has public transit, and therefore the transit system itself created the problem. So until a person moves into anywhere else, then they should be covered under like a grandfather because they previously had it and it was transit's fault that they don't have it. Is there any, do I have much of a way of thinking that I eventually can get through to them?
I'll tell you what the challenge is. Legally, they have no requirement to do that. Ethically, it's an ethically interesting question because if you are a bus rider and you bought a house and you use transit and you're not disabled, but you use that bus and they cancel your bus route, you are just as stranded as a paratransit rider who depended on that paratransit. So
a paratransit rider that is not disabled could very likely walk to the local, you know, the closest bus paratransit. So
yeah, I don't want to.
We
could argue scenarios all day long. The fact of the matter is, this is why I think that paratransit should be tied to a community and not to a bus route, because the real issue for most people is that they don't have access to the ability to drive. But the ADA ties transit, paratransit, to public transit, and public transit has the right to cut service, and they have a legal responsibility only to provide paratransit where they provide fixed route transit. So there's nothing in the law. The ethics are complicated because if you're poor and you're in an area and you depend on that bus and they take that bus away and you can't walk to the nearest bus stop because it's far, because there's no more bus routes, you're stranded just like the disabled person is. And I don't want to argue that. I mean, it is what it is. That's why paratransit should tie to something other than where buses operate, in my opinion.
Amen.
Yes.
Amen. Wow. So, Ron, if you mm-hmm. want to wrap it up in a couple of words to, as you said, inform, inspire, and motivate, and all those other grandiose things. What do you want to say to CCV?
We have not talked about equity at all, but I want to tell you, this is my belief. Two things. The ADA requires transit that's accessible to people with disabilities. An inclusive society, okay, which is, I think, what we should be aiming for, requires transportation that doesn't financially, economically, and emotionally drain you by the process of using it. Equity says that everybody should have the same access to what society offers. Until our public transportation system does that, we do not have equity. We need to fight for equity that gives people with disabilities the same access to everything that society offers, and that includes the ability to move about. So, you know, what I'm advocating for and what I hope CCB will advocate for is that broader definition of true equity, which is we get to travel just like other people travel when and where they want, and on the same time frame that other people are able to do it.
Oh, that's beautiful. And Ron, we're going to invite you back for future things. Like the whole time you were talking, I got motivated in a lot of ways. So, and many people know here, Sarah gets an idea, watch out. So,
right. So thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, and thank you. And thank you for the prize. I'm so jealous of Jason Holloway. My gosh.
Yeah, me too. It's good stuff. All right.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so very much.
And thank you.
So this concludes the end of our second general session. I want to remind folks to come back at 6 p.m., which will be led by our very own Lisa Presley Thomas. And she will be herself then, and Vanalisa and everybody else all at the same time, because that's what we do. And if you are a delegate or an alternate delegate, make sure you are joining in tonight. That information has been sent out to the president's list, and I will make sure that I send it out to both lists just in case. If you do not have that webinar, because it is a different webinar, please email convention.ccb@gmail.com and I will help you out. I promise. May take me a bit, but I'm going to try to do my best because that's what I try all the time.
And Sarah, since it was sent to the president's list, should we also maybe let people know they can contact their presidents just so that you're not potentially inundated?
We can say that too if they want to try to do that. So, you know, it's all about who. However you can get the information. I'm just trying to be helpful. And I was just going to ask you, Mr. President, do you have any words before we close?
I don't think so. Great session this afternoon. Thank you to all of our presenters for being here. And I'm just glad that I live in the Bay Area. Maybe I can invite or wrangle an invitation from Jason.
Yeah, really. Chocolate sounds good.
For the chocolate. So let's finish with one more door prize and let's close it out. Go for it, Lisa Vanna, Vanna Lisa.
Okay, let's do another $25 Amazon gift card. This one was given by Glendale Burbank Chapter. Let's do a good shuffle. Here we go. And the winner is Steve Bauer. Congratulations.
Hey, all right. All right,
Steve.
Hey, Steve.
All right. Well, happy Friday the 13th again, everybody. And we will all see you back here at 6 p.m.